Hello, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners at 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield. We got two stories here today. They're both very short, so that's why. The first one is called Call First by Ramsey Campbell. It was the other porters who made Ned determined to know who answered the phone in the old man's house. Not that he hadn't wanted to know before. He'd felt it was his right almost as soon as the whole thing had begun, months ago. He'd been sitting behind his desk in the library entrance, waiting for someone to try to take a bag into the library so he could shout after them that they couldn't, when the reference librarian ushered the old man up to Ned's desk and said, "Let this gentleman use your phone." Maybe he hadn't meant every time the old man came to the library, but then he should have said so. The old man used to talk to the librarian and tell him things about books even he didn't know, which is why he let him phone. All Ned could do was feel resentful. People weren't supposed to use his phone, and even he wasn't allowed to phone outside the building. And it wasn't as if the old man's calls were interesting. Ned wouldn't have minded if they'd been worth hearing. "I'm coming home now." That was all he ever said. Then he'd put down the receiver and hurry away. It was the way he said it that made Ned wonder. There was no feeling behind the words. They sounded as if he were saying them only because he had to, perhaps wishing he needn't. Ned knew people talked like that. His parents did in church and most of the time at home. He wondered if the old man was calling his wife because he wore a ring on his wedding finger, although in the claw where a stone would be was what looked like a piece of yellow fingernail. But Ned didn't think it could be his wife. Each day the old man came, he left the library at the same time, so why would he bother to phone? Then there was the way the old man looked at Ned when he phoned, as if he didn't matter and couldn't understand, the way most of the porters looked at him. That was the look that swelled up inside Ned one day and made him persuade one of the other porters to take charge of his desk while Ned waited to listen in on the old man's call. The girl who always smiled at Ned was on the switchboard, and they listened together. They heard the phone in the house ringing, then lifted, and the old man's call and his receiver going down. Nothing else, not even breathing, apart from the old man's. "Who do you think it is?" the girl said, but Ned thought she'd laugh if he said he didn't know. He shrugged extravagantly and left. Now he was determined. The next time the old man came to the library, Ned phoned his house, having read what the old man dialed. When the ringing began, its pulse sounded deliberately slow, and Ned felt the pumping of his blood rushing ahead. Seven trills, and the phone in the house opened with a violent click. Ned held his breath, but all he could hear was his blood thumping in his ears. "Hello," he said, and after a silence, clear in his throat, "Hello." Perhaps it was one of those answering machines people in films used in the office. He felt foolish and uneasy greeting the wide, silent metal ear and put down the receiver. He was in bed and falling asleep before he wondered why the old man should tell an answering machine that he was coming home. The following day, in the bar where all the porters went at lunchtime, Ned told them about the silently listening phone.
"He's weird, that old man," he said.
But now the others had finished joking with him. They no longer seemed interested, and he had to make a grab for the conversation. "He reads weird books," he said. "All about witches and magic. Real ones, not stories." "Now tell us something we didn't know," someone said, and the conversation turned its back on Ned. His attention began to wander. He lost his hold on what was being said. He had to smile and nod as usual when they looked at him, and he was thinking, "They're looking at me like the old man does. I'll show them. I'll go in his house and see who's there. Maybe I'll take something that'll show I've been there. Then they'll have to listen." But next day at lunchtime, when he arrived at the address he'd seen on the old man's library card, Ned felt more like knocking at the front door and running away. The house was menacingly big, the end house of a street whose other windows were brightly bricked up. Exposed foundations like broken teeth protruded from the mud that surrounded the street, while the mud was walled in by a 5-story crescent of flats that looked as if it had been designed in sections to be fitted together by a 2-year-old. Ned tried to keep the house between him and the flats, even though they were hundreds of yards away, as he peered in the windows. All he could see through the grimy front window was bare floorboards. When he coaxed himself to look through the side window, the same. He dreaded being caught by the old man, even though he'd seen him sitting behind a pile of books 10 minutes ago. It had taken Ned that long to walk here. The old man couldn't walk so fast, and there wasn't a bus he could catch. At last he dodged around the back and peered into the kitchen. A few plates in the sink, some tins of food, an old cooker. Nobody to be seen. He returned to the front, wondering what to do. Maybe he'd knock after all. He took hold of the bar of the knocker, trying to think what he'd say, and the door opened. The hall leading back to the kitchen was long and dim. Ned stood shuffling indecisively on the step. He would have to decide soon, for his lunch hour was dwindling. It was like one of the empty houses he'd used to play in with the other children, daring each other to go up the tottering stairs. Even the things in the kitchen didn't make it seem lived in. He'd show them all. He went in, acknowledging a vague idea that the old man's companion was out. He closed the door to hear if they returned. On his right was the front room. On his left, past the stairs and the phone, another of the bare rooms he'd seen. He tiptoed upstairs. The stairs creaked and swayed a little, perhaps unused to anyone of Ned's weight. He reached the landing, breathing heavily, feeling dust chafe his throat. Stairs led up to a closed attic door, but he looked in the rooms of the landing. 2 of the doors, which he opened stealthily, showed him nothing but boards and flurries of floating dust. The landing in front of the third looked cleaner, as if the door were often opened. He pulled it toward him, holding it up all the way so it didn't scrape the floor, and went in. Most of it didn't seem to make sense. There was a single bed with faded sheets. Against the walls were tables and piles of old books. Even some of the books looked disused. There were black candles and racks of small cardboard boxes. On one of the tables lay a single book. Ned padded across the fragments of carpet and opened the book in a thin path of sunlight that came through the shutters. Inside the sagging covers was a page Ned slowly realized had been ripped from the Bible. It was the story of Lazarus. Scribbles that might be letters filled the margins, and at the bottom of the page, written, Page 491. Suddenly inspired, Ned turned to that page in the book. It showed a drawing of a corpse sitting up in his coffin, but the book was all in the language they sometimes use in church, Latin. He thought of asking one of the librarians what it meant. Then he remembered that he needed proof he'd been in the house. He stuffed the page from the Bible into his pocket. As he crept swiftly downstairs, something was troubling him. He reached the hall and thought he knew what it was. He still didn't know who lived in the house with the old man. If they lived in the back, perhaps there would be signs in the kitchen. Though if it was his wife, Ned thought as he hurried down the hall, she couldn't be like Ned's mother, who would never have left torn strips of wallpaper hanging at shoulder height from both walls. He'd reached the kitchen door when he realized what had been bothering him. When he'd emerged from the bedroom, the attic door had been open. He looked back involuntarily and saw a woman walking away from him down the hall. He was behind the closed kitchen door before he had time to feel fear. That came only when he saw that the back door was nailed rustily shut. Then he controlled himself. She was only a woman. She couldn't do much if she found him. He opened the door minutely. The hall was empty. Halfway down the hall, he had to slip into the side room, heart punching his chest, for she'd appeared again from between the stairs and the front door. He felt the beginnings of anger and recklessness, and they grew faster when he opened the door and had to flinch back as he saw her hand passing. The fingers looked famished, the color of old lard, with long, yellow, cracked nails. There was no nail on her wedding finger, which wore a plain ring. She was returning from the direction of the kitchen, which was why Ned hadn't expected her. Through the opening of the door, he heard her padding upstairs. She sounded barefoot. He waited until he couldn't hear her, then edged out into the hall. The door began to swing open behind him with a faint creak, and he drew it stealthily closed. He paced through the front door. If he hadn't seen her shadow creeping down the stairs, he would have come face to face with her. He'd retreated to the kitchen and was near to panic when he realized she knew he was in the house. She was playing a game with him. At once he was furious. She was only an old woman. Her body beneath the long white dress was sure to be as thin as her hands. She could only shout when she saw him. She couldn't stop him leaving. In a minute he'd be late for work. He threw open the kitchen door and swaggered down the hall. The sight of her lifting the phone receiver broke his stride for a moment. Perhaps she was phoning the police. He hadn't done anything. She could have her Bible page back. But she laid the receiver beside the phone. Why? Was she making sure the old man couldn't ring? As she unbent from stooping to the phone, she grasped two uprights of the banisters to support herself. They gave a loud, splintering creak and bent together. Ned halted, confused. He was still struggling to react when she turned towards him and he saw her face. Part of it was still on the bone. He didn't back away until she began to advance on him, her nails tearing new strips from both walls. All he could see was her protruding eyes, unsupported by flesh. His mind was backing away faster than he was, but it had come up against a terrible insight. He even knew why she made sure the old man couldn't interrupt until she'd finished. His calls weren't like speaking to an answering machine at all. They were exactly like switching off a burglar alarm. Well, that's the end of that story. And, well, that's what he gets for breaking and entering. Let this be a warning to those who get too curious about this kind of thing. Anyway, on to the next story. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners. We just read a story by Ramsey Campbell called Call First. And this story is called The Kelpie by Manly Wade Wellman. No sooner had Cannon closed and latched the door than Lou was in his arms, and they were kissing with the hungry fierceness of lovers who doubt their own good fortune. Thus for a delirious, heart-battering moment. Then Lou pulled nervously away.
"We're being watched," she whispered breathlessly.
The big, dark man laughed down at her worried blue eyes, her shining wealth of ale-brown hair, her face like an ivory heart, the apprehensive tautness of her slender figure. "That's guilty conscience, Lou," he teased. "You know I wouldn't have invited you to my apartment without giving my man the night off. And even if someone did see us, why be afraid? Don't we love each other?" She allowed him to bring her into the parlor and draw her down beside him on a divan, but she still mused apprehensively.
"I could swear there were eyes upon us," she insisted, half apologetically. "Hostile eyes."
"Maybe they're spirits," Cannon cried happily, his own twinkling gaze sweeping around to view in turn the paintings on the walls, the hooded lamps, the bookshelves, the rich, comfortable furniture, the big box-shaped aquarium in the darkest corner. Again, he chuckled. "Spirits, that's a pun, you know. The lowest form of wit." From a tabouret at his elbow, he lifted a decanter of brandy and poured two drinks with a humorous flourish. Lou, forgetting her uneasiness of a moment before, lifted her glass.
"To us," she toasted.
But Cannon set his own drink down, untasted, and peered around a second time, this time without gaiety. "You've got me thinking it now," he muttered.
"Thinking what?"
"That something is watching, and not liking what it sees." He glanced quickly over his shoulder, then continued, as if seeking to reassure them both. "Nothing in that corner, of course, except the aquarium."
"What's the latest tenantry there?"
Lou asked, glad to change the disquieting subject. "Some Scotch water plants. A new laboratory project." Cannon was at ease the moment his hobby came into the conversation. "They arrived this afternoon in a sealed tin box. Dr. Mackenzie's letter says they were gathered from the pool kelp, wherever that is, in his highland wilderness. I'm letting them soak and wash overnight. In the morning, I'll begin experimenting." Lou sipped more brandy, her eyes interested.
"Pool kelp," she repeated. "It sounds seaweedy."
"But these are freshwater growths. As I say, I never heard of the pool before." Cannon broke off. "Here, though, why talk botany when we can..." His lips abruptly smothered hers. His arms gathered her so close as to bruise her. But even as she yielded happily to his embrace, the telephone rang loudly in the front entry. Cannon released her with a muttered curse of impatience, rose, and hurried out to answer. He closed the door behind him, and his voice, muffled and indistinct, sounded aggrieved as he spoke into the transmitter. Lou, finishing her brandy alone, picked up the drink Cannon had set down. As she lifted it to her lips, she glanced idly over the rim of the glass at the moist tangle in the aquarium. In the dim light, it seemed to fall into all manner of rich greens. Darkest emerald, beryl, malachite, olive, grass, lettuce. Something moved, too. Flipped and swerved in the heart of the little submerged grove. Cannon was still talking. Lou rose, drink in hand, to stroll curiously toward the big glass box. As she did so, the moving trifle seemed to glide upward toward the surface. Coming closer yet, Lou paused to peer in the half-light. A fish? If so, a very green fish, and a very small one. Perhaps a tadpole. A bubble broke audibly on top of the water. Lou, genuinely interested, bent closer, just as something rose through the little ripples and hooked its tip on the rim of the aquarium. It was a tiny, spinach-colored hand. Half a second later, another fringe of tiny fingers appeared, clutching the rim in turn. Lou, woodenly motionless, stared in her effort to rationalize. She could see the tiny digits, each tapering and flexible, each armed with a jet-colored claw. Through the glass, under and beneath the fingers, she made out thumbs, deft, opposable thumbs, and smooth, wet palms of a dead, oystery gray. Her breath caught in mute, helpless astonishment. A blunt head rose slowly into view behind and between the fists, something with flat brow, broad lump of nose, and wide mouth, like a grotesque Mayan mask. And it was growing. Lou told herself a little stupidly that she must not have seen it clearly at first. She had thought the creature a little green minnow, but it was as big as a squirrel. No, as big as a baby. Its bright green eyes, white-ringed, fixed hers, projecting a wave of malignant challenge that staggered her like a blow. The full, lead-hued lips parted loosely, and the forked tip of a purple tongue quivered out for a moment. A snaky odor steamed up to Lou's nostrils, making her dizzy and weak. Wet, scabby green shoulders had heaved into view by now, and after them, the twin mounds of her grotesquely feminine bosom. The thing was climbing out at her, and as it did so, it swelled and grew. The brandy glass fell from her hand and loudly exploded into splinters upon the floor. The sound of the breaking gave Lou back her voice, and she screamed tremulously, then managed to move back and away, half stumbling and half staggering. The monster, all damp and green and stinking, was writhing a leg into view. Lou noted that, and then everything else went into a whirling white blur, and she began to collapse. Faintly, she heard the rush of Cannon's feet, felt the clutch of his strong arms as though many thicknesses of fabric separated them from her. He almost shouted her name in panic. After a moment, her sight and mind cleared, and she looked up into his concerned face. With all her shaken strength, she clung to him. "That thing!" she chattered. "That horrid female thing in the aquarium!" Cannon managed a comforting tone. "But there's nothing, dearest. Nothing at all. Those two brandies, you took mine too, you shameless glutton, went to your head." "Look at it!" She pointed an unsteady finger. "Deep down there in the weeds!"
He looked.
Oh, that? He laughed. I noticed it too, just before you came. It's a little frog or toad. Must have been gathered with the weeds and shipped all the way from Scotland.
Lou caressed her throbbing forehead with her slender white hand and mumbled something about seeing things. Already she believed that she had somehow dreamed of the green water monster. Still, it was a distinct effort to walk with Cannon to the aquarium and look in. Through the thick tangle of stems and fronds that made a dank stew in the water, she could make out a tiny something that wriggled and glided. It was only minnow-sized, after all, and seemed smooth and innocuous. Funny what notions two quick drinks will give you. She lowered a cupped palm toward the surface, as if to scoop down and seize the little creature. But the chilly touch of the topmost weed tips repelled her, and she drew back her arm.
You'd never catch it, Cannon told her. It won't wait for you to grab. I had a try when I first saw it, and got a wet sleeve. And this.
He held out his left hand. For the first time that evening, Lou saw the gold band that he wore on his third finger.
A ring, her lover explained. It was lying on the bottom. Apparently, it came with the weeds, too.
You put it on your wedding finger, Lou wailed.
That was the only one it would fit, Cannon defended as she caught his hand and tugged with all her might at the ring. It did not budge.
Please, she begged, get rid of it.
Why, Lou? What's the trouble? Are you being jealous because a present was given to me by that mess of weed? Or maybe by the little lady frog?
The tiny swimmer in the tank splashed water as if in punctuation of his joke, and Cannon, falling abruptly silent, suddenly began wrenching at the gold circlet. But not even his strength, twice that of Lou, could bring it over the joint.
Here, I don't like this, he announced, his voice steady but a little tight. I'm going to put soap on my finger. That will make the thing slip off.
Lou made no reply, but her eyes encouraged him. Cannon kissed her pale forehead, strode across the room, and into a little corridor beyond. After a moment, Lou could hear the spurt of a water jet in a bowl, then the sound of industrious scrubbing with lather. In command of herself once again, but still a trifle faint and shaky, Lou leaned her hand lightly upon the thick, smooth edge of the aquarium glass. A fond little smile came to her lips as she pondered on Cannon's eagerness to please her whim. Not even in a silly little matter like this one did he cross her will or offer argument that might embarrass or hurt her. The shedding of that ring would be a symbol between them of understanding and faith. Her eyes dropped to the table that stood against the aquarium, with its litter of papers and notebooks. At the edge nearest Lou lay a thick volume bound in gray. A dictionary. What was the term she had puzzled over? Oh, yes. Still lounging with one hand on the glass, she flipped the book open with the other and turned the pages to the K's. Kelp. Any one of the various large brown seaweeds of the families Lamoinaceae and Fucaceae. Her hazy memory had been right then about the word. But why should a body of fresh water be called pool kelp? Glancing back at the page, her eyes caught the next definition. It answered her question. Kelpie, a malicious water spirit or demon believed to haunt streams or marshes. Sometimes it falls in love with human beings, striving jealously against mortal rivals.
The words swam before her vision, for the snake smell had risen sickeningly around her, and something was gripping the hand that rested on the rim of the tank. Lou's mouth opened, but, as before, terror throttled her. Like a sleeper in the throes of nightmare, she struggled half-heartedly. She dared not look, yet some power forced her head around. The grip had shifted to her wrist. Long, claw-tipped fingers were clamped there, fingers as large as her own, scrofulous green and of a swampy chill. Lou's eyes slid in fascinated horror along the scale-ridged, corded arm to the moldy-looking body, stuck and festooned over with weed fronds that was rising from the water. Another foul hand stole swiftly out, fastened on Lou's shoulder, and jerked her close. The flat, grotesque face, grown to human size, was level with hers, its eyes triumphant within their dead white rings, its dark tongue quivering between gaping lips. Yet again, Lou tried to find her voice. All she could achieve was a wordless moan, no louder than a sigh. "Did you call, sweetheart?" came Cannon's cheery response from his washing. "I'll be with you in a minute now. This thing is still hanging on like a poor relation." The reptilian jaw dropped suddenly, like the lid of a box turned upside down. Lou stared into the slate-gray cave that was the yawning mouth. Teeth, sharp teeth, gleamed there. Not one row, but many. Lou's hands lifted feebly in an effort at defense, then dropped wearily to her sides. The monster crinkled its humid features in something like a triumphant grin. Then its blunt head shot forward with incredible swiftness, nuzzling Lou at the juncture of neck and shoulder. For a moment, she felt exquisite pain, as of many piercing needles. After that, she neither felt, heard, nor saw anything. The medical examiner was drawing a sheet over the still, agony-distorted body of the dead girl. The police sergeant, scribbling his final notes, addressed Cannon with official sternness. "Sorry," he said, "but you haven't explained this business at all satisfactorily. You come down to headquarters with me." Cannon glanced wanly up from his senseless wrestling with the ring that would not quit his wedding finger. "I didn't do it," he reiterated dully. The medical examiner was also speaking, more to himself than anyone. An autopsy might clear up some points. Those inflamed, suppurated wounds on the neck might have been made by a big water snake. Or, he added, with a canny glance at the sergeant, by a poisoned weapon constructed to simulate such a creature's bite. Cannon's last vestige of control went. "I tell you," he snarled desperately, "that she and I were the only living things here tonight. The only living things." He broke off, becoming aware of movement in the aquarium. "Except, of course, that little frog in there." The creature among the weeds, a tiny sliver of agile greenness, cavorted for a moment on the surface of the water, as if in exultation. Then, before any of the three watchers could get a fair look at it, dived deep into the heart of the floating mess. Well, that was terrifying. The Kelpie had set her sights on the guy, and he had no idea. Well, that's it for today. As usual, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners. I enjoyed reading, and I hope you enjoyed listening. I'll see you next time.